You're listening to A Stranger Podcast, www.thestranger.com.
Hi, you're listening to Invisible, The Stranger's Conversation with People in Art. I'm Jen Graves. I'm at the Henry Art Gallery with the director, Sylvia Wolfe. Hi.
Hi, Jen.
We are talking about the show of Robert Mapplethorpe's Polaroids that you curated and that began its life at the Whitney Museum of American Art, where you were working before this. And now the show is here in Seattle, and I want to go back, though, to... There's also a book, I should add, but I want to go back to how you got involved in this project in the first place.
Let me start by saying I am very excited that it's here in my new home, because I've become thoroughly enthralled with this body of work. It's been a love affair of sorts with discovering something about an artist that I never could have imagined. And that is how personal, how intimate, how spontaneous and delightful these pictures are. The love affair began when the president of the Mapplethorpe Foundation, who was on my collection committee at the Whitney and was a personal friend and continues to be, invited me to the archive of the foundation just to look around to see if there was any potential exhibition idea or research idea I might find. And that's one of the things I love about the foundation, is that they are actively, regularly promoting not just Robert's work for exhibition, but also the sale of his work, which goes towards AIDS research. Taking him up on his offer, the invitation to come and poke around the archive was too good to resist. I asked the archive manager if there was anything I should see that was outside of the norm. Not the usual suspects, the works that had been published heavily, but was there anything odd, anything quirky, anything that had been under-recognized or not even really put on view. She took me to a back part of the storage facility and reached up to the top level of a shelf and pulled down a three-ring binder and opened it up. And in archival plastic sleeves were hundreds of these small black and white Polaroid photographs. They're unique. They are between 3.5 and 4.5 inches. That's one size. The other size is 4 by 5 inches, no bigger. And as I stood there and flipped from page to page and looked at, I must have looked at 1,000 that first day, I had what is a real treat and a privilege for anybody in research. And that is an experience of knee-knocking, breath-taking, I don't want to say confusion, but literally having the rug taken out from underneath, one, because you're seeing something so unexpected that you can't quite put it in context and you don't quite know what to make of it. That's a source of great energy and joy for somebody who is a researcher, who's a detective of sorts. At the same time, I was skeptical. Am I seeing more in these pictures than is really there because of Mapplethorpe's career and notoriety and the art that came later? Are these truly special, or would I take as much interest in them if they weren't by Mapplethorpe? Those were the questions I then left the archive with thinking about. And over a period of about a year and a half, I went back and forth, maybe 4 times, still asking myself those same questions. And after about a year and a half's time, I realized that, yes, it's important that these are by Mapplethorpe, and yes, they're spectacular. So it's not an either-or. And I wanted to study them, which then led to proposing it as an exhibition to my colleagues at the Whitney, and the rest was the kind of work I've done for over 20 years, which is ask a lot of questions, ask a lot of people, and look a lot.
And there are how many works in the show? How many Polaroids?
There are 97, I believe, in the exhibition.
And is that the total? Is that the same number that have been in the exhibition at, that had been at the exhibition at the Whitney?
There were a few more. No, there were a few different ones. There were some loans from the Guggenheim Museum in the Whitney show that did not get approved for travel. Okay. The show has since gone to the Block Gallery in Evanston outside of Chicago and Modern Art Museum Oxford in England.
And the Guggenheim works were not Polaroids, I presume?
No, some were.
Oh, really?
Some were. And there were a couple of objects. We have one object in a case here. Robert would take some of the color Polaroids in particular and some of the black and whites, and he would place them inside of the cassette that held the film before it went in the camera. And he would use the cassette, which is a plastic frame-like device, and spray paint it different colors, pink, yellow, green, and then put a photograph in as though it was a ready-made frame. Mm-hmm. So framing a photograph of Patti Smith, for example, in a pink or a blue plastic holder of the original film. Those works, particularly if they're color, can be fragile and vulnerable, and some museums don't want them traveling, and I have to respect that. Having made those kinds of calls in my capacity as a curator with our conservator weighing in, I understand.
Yeah.
So in that instance, what we did was we switched out a couple of works and got additional ones from the Mapplethorpe Foundation. So the numbers have remained relatively consistent.
Okay. And there's the image at the beginning of the show. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about that?
Yes. Robert started as a studying graphic design at Pratt Institute. And he thought he wanted to be a painter. In fact, he made some abstract paintings early on, and then became engaged with making collages. He would take pornographic magazines, homoerotic magazines, cut and paste, and put together collages that sometimes referenced his original Catholicism, which was the religion he was raised with in New Jersey. Sometimes they referenced male partnering and sex. And so cutting and pasting and putting things together was part of his very early practice before he even picked up the camera. Back in the late 60s and early 70s, you had to buy a pornographic magazine without perusing it because it was enclosed in plastic. And Robert didn't have a whole lot of money, so he was investing his resources in something without knowing whether there was any good stuff inside the plastic bag or not. And speaking about to Patti Smith, they were sharing a room at the Chelsea Hotel at that time. Speaking to Patti and speaking to a friend of Patti, Sandy Daly, who's a filmmaker, who was also a resident of the Chelsea Hotel, he was bemoaning the fact that he just bought a magazine and there wasn't anything good in it. Mm-hmm. And Sandy said, why don't you take your own pictures? I've got a Polaroid camera. It's instant. You can look at them, and you'll have what you want. And that's how he started. But from the moment he borrowed Sandy Daly's Polaroid camera, the collages fell to the wayside. He made some, continued to make some, but by and large, he became enthralled with picture making. So the piece that starts the show is a potato sack, what you would buy a pound of potatoes in at the grocery store, paper with a little bit of mesh in the front so they could breathe and not rot. It's flattened, and it's painted a purple color. So if you can envision this vertical paper that's been painted purple, and inside looking through the mesh, as though you're looking through a frame, you see three black and white Polaroids that he collaged together of his nude form. So the collage element of what he'd been doing before is there. Nudity, self-portraiture, which we'll see plenty of in his career to come, is there. The handmade quality of it, and what he called the altar aspect, because many of his early collages and installations that he made in his room in the Chelsea Hotel had multiple elements to it, sometimes Patty's T-shirts or a tie or something. And he thought of them as shrines or altars of sorts. So this has all of that. It's a single piece that's in the exhibition to set the tone, to say, here's the transition, here's one of his earlier uses of, earliest uses of Polaroid, and to prime you for what you're going to see from then on.
Who owns that?
Charles Coles.
Okay.
And Charles actually just recently gave it to a museum in Florida who has graciously agreed to lend it for the tour.
Mm. Is the Henry acquiring anything?
That's a wonderful question. That is a wonderful question. I would love to be able to get back to you on that one.
Okay. you know, there's so much to talk about here, and I know, you know, we just have a limited time. But I want to ask about the sense of intimacy, and I think the way that you put it in your essay in the book is sort of the aching sort of sense of longing that you see in a lot of these images. And I wanted to ask kind of whether you ever felt, whether there were images that you felt sort of bad about looking at, you know, that they were so, that they sort of were so very, so very intimate, you know. Mm. I'm thinking in particular, some of them are so tender, it's almost, I'm thinking of the ones of Sam Wagstaff in the bath, or...
Yeah.
And, I mean, not that you shouldn't be looking at them. Of course, he took these photographs and, you know, and in many cases framed them and was very deliberate about presenting them as objects. So not to say that there's anything wrong with any of that. But I was curious about what it kind of brought up for you, because they are such small little universes that you just have to project yourself into in a very, like, personal way, I think.
I felt privileged to look. I don't have any recollection of ever feeling voyeuristic. He did present some of these Polaroids at an early exhibition, his first exhibition at Light Gallery in 1973. Sadly, there are no records in Light's archives of a checklist or what was on view. And try as I might, I have interviewed people, spoken to the widow of the director at the time, had people dig in the archives. So we don't know whether any of the ones in this show were shown then, whether he deemed those showable or public. But what I do feel is that an aspect of Robert's creative process is here. And I've come to truly believe that he would not have gotten from the shrines and collages and homoerotic works in multimedia that he started with to the work we now know without this intermediate step of picture taking.
Did you know him?
No, I did not. No.
That must be interesting, too, sort of getting to know him after his death.
That's right. That's right.
New way.
Well, and interestingly, having done research on numerous artists, and in particular, one memorable one, a 19th century Victorian portraitist, I got to know her through her writing, through her letters, as well as her pictures. Robert didn't keep notebooks and sketches, and so all we have are the pictures and then sometimes the subjects. Patty Smith has been phenomenal in helping me understand this body of work.
That must have been interesting. Mm. What was it like talking with her? How often did you meet with her?
Not often. She's a busy person. and in fact, I touched base with her a couple of times about factual things, but she was always very generous in talking about her experience of posing with or working. She considered it working with Robert, not posing for Robert. She continues to be a big champion of his. She's going to be here at Seattle Arts and Lectures in the winter, speaking about the new book that she wrote about them.
Yeah. And I heard Rock My Religion might be screened here.
We're talking about
working
it.
Working on it.
Mm-hmm.
That could be interesting. You know, when I look at some of these images, there's so many different photographers in these that he's trying on so many different roles. And at the same time, in so many cases, you just have the feeling it couldn't be anybody else shooting these. What do you think are the most surprising images for you? And for people who recognize Mapplethorpe, right? So who have a kind of, you know, basic sort of understanding. What are the most surprising things?
There are two pictures. One is in the beginning of the show. It is of a telephone, a rotary telephone, in a hotel room in England. I only know all that now because I've traced it, but the picture doesn't tell you where it is. It's taken from the angle of placing the camera on or just below the edge of the table where this phone is sitting. The phone is centrally placed. It's as though it's a portrait of the phone as well as a still life study. And the depth of field that the Polaroid camera he was using at the time has a shallowness that would throw anything in the foreground or in the background out of focus. And so that further enhances the fact that this feels like a portrait because the phone is sharp, whereas the surroundings are soft. And it's just beautiful and anthropomorphized in a funny kind of a way for me. It's an ordinary object. There's no literal sex appeal to it, but it has a visual beauty and elegance that I find compelling. And what it does is it also, I feel myself seeing through Robert's eyes. If I had been standing next to him, I wouldn't have seen that phone that way. He saw it that way. So I'm also aware when I look at it of Robert's presence and his eyes and how and what he was looking at. So that was one of the ones, that first visit that just stopped me and I had to think about for a while. Some of his flower, there are two pictures in the show of flowers that are very much unlike what you would expect to see from later on. There's one sweet romantic picture of a loosely tied bouquet on a pillow of a bed at a slight angle. So it appears to have been placed there, and yet there's something romantic and touching about it. And the other one is some flowers in a vase, and they're a little past their prime. They're a little Victorian in that regard. They're not slick, and they're slightly soft in focus, and the lighting is a sort of sfumato, a sort of smoky lighting to it. So those two are what come to mind the most.
Yeah. The use of the Polaroid is something that he's developing, right?
Yes.
And in some cases it feels like he's, there's that one image where he's sort of fumbling toward the camera, and it looks like it sort of goes off by accident. And I wanted to ask you, how many images of that kind did you find that he had saved, where it sort of really shows his not quite being in control of the camera in the way that he's known for later?
A lot. And that actually was part of what was so interesting about this body of work, is there are, of the roughly 1,500 to 1,800, which I've loosely calculated in my head that I've seen, there are a lot of them where he's learning how to use the materials. In some cases, and Polaroid black and white film back then, when you separated the negative from the positive, the unique object, which you see on view here, you had to coat it with it looks almost like a squeegee that was coated with fixing agent. And if you didn't coat it evenly, it would streak. And there are a number of examples where, for condition reasons or whatever, the objects just didn't survive. There are some where you see him slightly adjusting and varying the position. The image that you're talking about, where he's holding the camera up and looking up at it, is marvelous because, of course, he can't see through the viewfinder to see whether he succeeded or not, but he can see the results within minutes. And that instantaneous quality I think, is crucial. I don't know that he would have become a photographer had he not been working with materials that he could see right then and there and adjust to, both in the private pictures, and when I say private, I mean a couple of things. I mean pictures he was taking for himself, or the private pictures, the pictures he was taking of sexual encounters with others. Then that became part of the dynamic of taking a picture with someone else, and they can see it, and then there's a more of a collaborative aspect to it.
And there's that gratification.
Yes.
That
gratification. Instant gratification.
Keeps the process going, you know. And you write about it as a part of his sex life.
Correct.
Photographing as a part of sex life. There's one image that really surprised me, and I don't think it's in the book, but it's in the show, where... I could be wrong about that, but it's somebody, maybe him, I'm not sure, kneeling on a platform.
Oh yeah.
With his butt in the air, but turned away from the camera. So there's a sort of total sexual openness advertised by the image, but it's reversed because you aren't seeing anything. You know, the camera isn't capturing. It's only capturing the gesture, not the not the openness itself, since the person is turned the other way. And it looked like him. It looked like the robe. Yeah, is that him? And then,
you know,
is that the robe?
I wondered whether that was him.
It is in the book. I'm sorry.
It is in the book. And I wondered whether that was him. I don't know. And I asked David Crowland, who was also enormously gracious and generous with time and sharing stories and sharing works from his own collection, who was Robert's first lover. And he could look and say, oh, I recognize the mole in the back or whatever. He couldn't. He wasn't sure. So I don't know. What I love about that image feels to me like a figure pouring off of the platform. And it's unbelievably elegant from a figurative standpoint. A number of his figure studies are really exquisite and beautiful.
Yeah. Which of the sort of images of, you know, the images of lovers they really range. You know, some of them are so posed. There's that sort of overly blonde guy.
Yes, Randy.
Randy. Who's posed as sort of like a painted skeleton.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just really funny. And then, you know, Sam appearing so many times in this really just offhand kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
What about those, you know, I guess, you know, were you looking for when you were choosing? Because you selected from so many. You know, were you looking for that range, or how did you...
Many of the male figures were not necessarily lovers, interestingly enough. He loved beauty. And it was in my research and identifying some of these people that I learned that, oh no, that was a friend of his who was married and had two kids and no sexual relationship at all. But Robert admired his physique, his face, his profile. So Mapplethorpe's attraction to beauty in a classical sense was in place then, and then continued to grow.
And you see those kind of theatrical, they're so ridiculous.
Oh, yeah.
These ones where it's almost a stage set, this kind of Victorian.
Well, those are fat. That's Giles Fontaine. He was, that's the star of Bloodsucking Freaks, which is a cult movie. I can't say that I've seen it myself.
You haven't?
No.
Oh, we have to screen it here.
I'm missing something, I can tell. But yes, those are hilarious. And the sense of humor, that's the other thing. There's a sense of humor in some of these pictures. I really feel like I'm looking at his diary, or I've been invited to consider the things that tickled his fancy.
Mm-hmm.
There's a picture, for example, looking out a window through lace curtains down onto the street out of a hotel window in London. And if you look carefully, you see the signage for a plumbing shop down below, and it says Potties, P-O-T-T-I-E-S. Mm-hmm. Well, Robert would have gotten a kick out of that and thought that was funny from a language and linguistical standpoint. So we made a picture of it.
What about these images with projections on this? It's a chair draped with a sheet, mm-hmm. and then there are video projections on that, these sort of beefcake projections. Those are really interesting.
Well, and what's compelling about those is that the imagery comes from Physique magazines, and Robert collected Physique magazines. Physique magazines really came into the forefront around the turn of the century into the teens as a way of celebrating the male figure, not necessarily for homoerotic purposes, but I'm trying to remember when the first Mr. America contest was. I want to say it was in either 1913 or 1931. It's in the book somewhere. But what Physique magazines served as a purpose was to give images of men for the delectation of other men who enjoyed looking at images of men. And interestingly and importantly, in 1962, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that pornographic images of men were no more offensive than pornographic images of women. At that point, porno magazines of women could be mailed, but porno magazines of men could not. And in 1962, the transcripts are hilarious, by the way, of the arguments in very serious legal terms about why equal rights should extend to porno magazines featuring male figures. And so then magazines could be sent, and Physique magazines had a resurgence in their popularity that was unprecedented. So that's some of the backstory of these two pictures. Both pictures come from Physique magazines.
How funny, and their circulation at that time becomes mm-hmm. a sort of... there's also there are some just really formal pictures. I'm thinking of the brick wall.
Yes.
It's just sort of like an abstraction.
Well, it is an abstraction. It's also at a time when Robert and Sam Wagstaff, his partner, benefactor, lover, a longtime collector and curator, they by then were collecting photographs together. They each had their own independent collection, but they went looking and shopping together. So they were looking at Minor White. They were looking at Ansel Adams. They were certainly looking at Julia Margaret Cameron and collecting. And they were collecting any number of artists who looked at photography as an art, number one, and number two, would look at ordinary subjects for the quality, the texture, and the composition it afforded once photographed.
Mm-hmm. I mean, do you think that, have you talked to, I mean, I'm really curious about how this body of work might influence photographers working today, especially since I think Polaroid just decided to come back into business. So, having briefly disappeared, have you talked to many artists about these images?
The artists who have spoken up about them have spoken up saying it's hard for people today to realize that there was a time when instant imaging wasn't a part of our day-to-day, mm-hmm. wasn't part of our expectation in our image culture. So people have taught. I was surprised, actually, that one of the news stories that kept coming up in relation to this exhibition was about that, about the instant nature and digital photography now versus then. Will this body of work have an influence on other artists? That's a good question. You've invited me to think about that and ask other artists.
Well, there are some of those. I'd love to hear even somebody who already seems sort of familiar, somebody like Nan Golden, who has this sort of a private narrative that she's making these photographs out. And also the performance aspect, the way the series with the robe, where he's
wearing a robe. Well, first there's a robe on a hanger, and then he's reaching in to take the robe off the hanger, and then he's putting the robe on, and then he's taking the robe off. You know,
right.
The sense of
right.
kind of unmaking something before the camera.
That's right.
In front of the camera. And that all this came out of trying to and failing to know what was inside of a magazine because it was covered up is really a great kind of... Well, is there anything else that you want to talk about?
Well, one thing I should say, because it's important that you bring up that particular series, that the book and the exhibition are two autonomous entities for a couple of different reasons. One is the negatives for these Polaroids all exist in the foundation, but not all the actual prints. Over the years, sometimes the prints have been given away. Robert gave them to a friend. And in some cases, we were not able to locate the prints. But I did want to put it in the book because it's important to know these images exist. And we would scan from the negatives to print in the book. The series you're talking about right now is one of those cases.
Really?
So people won't come to the Henry and see the robe sequence because those originals are somewhere in the universe. One of the reasons of doing a show like this is that I know pictures are going to come out from the woodwork as people look and say, oh, he gave me this or I own that. That's one of the reasons why this is the beginning of a conversation about this body of work. And the other reason why the book has twice as many works in it, as well as a lot of context material, is because I consider the book to be really the story of Robert's engagement with Polaroid materials and its impact on his career as a whole. Whereas I want viewers to just go in and delight in the beauty of looking at these sweet little gems. And being both enthralled and provoked by them, because I continue to be both.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk about it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening.